Get everything you need to bring home the holidays on Black Friday at Menards. Doors open 6 a.m. A Nerf Blaster Dog Toy Blast Tennis Ball 75 feet. Fun for you and your pup. Just $15.99. Delicious Dubai Chocolate is $12.99 a bag. Color-changing Squish Lamps and Performax Drill Bit Sets are only $4.99 each. Menards has great Black Friday gifts for everyone in your family. Doors open 6 a.m. on Black Friday. Good through November 30th. See Menards.com for details.
Get ready to shop Lowe's Black Friday Doorbuster Deals to save $150 on a 30-inch Blackstone griddle, now $299. Plus, choose a Whirlpool top load washer or Midea top freezer refrigerator for just $398. These limited-time Doorbuster deals go fast, so get holiday ready today at Lowe's. We help, you save. Valid 11/28 through 12/1. Selection varies by location. While supplies last. See Lowe's.com for more details.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another very special, heartfelt for me, episode of the 1973 podcast. I'm happy to have somebody that I've been waiting to have on for a while. Bill Ranford, Conn Smythe champion, Stanley Cup champion, and hopefully by the end, I always say it, friend of the show. So, Bill, thank you so much for coming on and sharing some stories and chirping with the fellas, and we're going to have some fun and tell stories and talk about your career and what you're doing now, and we're going to have some fun with it.
Well, thanks for having me on. I really appreciate it.
So we always kind of start off as, you know, kids growing up playing. How did the youth hockey venture start? How did the goaltending start when you were younger? And let everybody know how that started.
Well, my dad was in the military. We were living up in Cold Lake, Alberta at the time. And one of his buddies, Derek Searle, was a goalie in just like the senior men's league there. And I think like a lot of guys, it's either their older brother needed a goalie to shoot on, or you're fascinated by the equipment. And for me, it was the fascination with the equipment. So I was into it right off the bat. And then I think my first set of pads I got while I was living in Cold Lake, and it was the old white pad Canadian Tire goalie pads. So those were my first set. So it was pretty exciting when I got those at Christmas.
So when you started as a youth, who was your favorite goalie growing up?
Well, I had two, and I don't think the Boston people are going to be happy with it. But number one was Ken Dryden. And number two was Mike Palmateer. I think Ken Dryden, just the fact that he went to school, that was important to me at that time, that he went to school and then became a professional hockey player. And then Mike Palmateer, I think just that athletic style and that he played, and it kind of probably a lot like the style that I ended up playing, a little bit more athletic than technical. So, but those were the two guys that, you know, I idolized growing up. And then a little bit later on, through marriage, Chico Resch, my mom's sister married a Resch. So he was the first NHL player that I got to meet out of the old Winnipeg Arena when I was originally going to see the New York Islanders, and then he got traded about a week before, and we were able to swap out our tickets. And when he went to Colorado, and I still got the chance to see him when Colorado came in a couple weeks later. So that was quite a thrill to finally meet him.
For the young fans at home, we're talking the Rockies. We're not talking the Avalanche.
Yeah, not the Avalanche. It was the Rockies, yeah. First time around in Colorado.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I always loved the colors. And Doug Favell played. They had a really cool mask when he played for them. And, you know, fond memories of that team as a kid. You're not the first person to mention those two guys as their favorite goalie on the show. We had Steve Passmore on, and he mentioned those two. And that's why he loved to wear number 29. So, for people that don't know, Mike Palmateer was better than average for a goalie, and masks.
Yeah, and then I think we relied on, obviously, living in Canada, on Hockey Night in Canada, and obviously they covered Montreal and Toronto a lot. And the story about Mike Palmateer having the bag of popcorn before every game, I thought that was pretty cool. So, you know, and then to, as, you know, a player, the first time going into that building and going by the little snack bar where he used to get his bag of popcorn before every game, that was a real thrill.
Yeah. So junior hockey into draft. How did that all come about? Did you have any aspirations that you were going to get drafted? Were they grooming you ahead of time, like going into, that draft?
I think I was pretty naive to the whole process. The only inkling that I got that I might be drafted was my father-in-law had a friend that was a part-time scout with the Vancouver Canucks when I was playing for the New Westminster Bruins here in New Westminster, so a little suburb of Vancouver. Yeah, so it at that time it wasn't as glorified as it is today. A lot more players go to the draft now. Back then, more the elite went, and so I was at my billet's place. We kind of had a little bit of a draft party in the basement, and I got the phone call from Boston that they had just drafted me. So it was a thrill, but a little bit surprised. But back then it just wasn't as glorified as it is today.
So when you're in Boston the first time, was there anybody that actually took you under their wing, or a good rookie story, or something that stands out? Statue of limitations?
Yeah, no. When I first got there, my first training camp, Pete Peters took me to an apple orchard, and we went to apple picking for the guys for training camp. And I was just, Pete was a guy that was, at the top of his game, and I wouldn't say I idolized him, but really respected his playing ability and his puck handling ability. And then somebody of that stature to take me in my first training camp and kind of show me around a little bit was pretty amazing. It was something I'll never forget. And then all the boys were pretty amazed that we came back with bags full of apples for guys to have at training camp. But I'll never forget that. I was treated very well. And then the other guy would be Derek Sanderson. Bunch of the young guys got stuck at the rink, and he had this big old Cadillac or something. I think it was a Cadillac, but a big ass vehicle. And he drove all the young guys back to the hotel, and he knew, that where we played, there was myself, I think Gordie Hines. I'm trying to think who else might have been there, but for sure it was Gordie and I. And he knew that we played in the Western Hockey League, knew a little bit about us, so that was pretty cool, because Derek Sanderson was the guy that my dad idolized, and my dad was a big Bruins fan, so to not only meet Derek and then get a ride back to the hotel with him was pretty amazing.
Yeah, I'm surprised that you're the first one that we've talked to on the podcast that's had a Derek Sanderson story, because there's certain guys that have that hockey lore to them, and he's one of them.
Well, yeah, absolutely, and obviously, he was doing, I think he was doing the TV or radio at that time. I'm not sure which one he was doing, because I think he might have started off in radio. But he just it was just amazing, because everybody knew who he was, and through Maxie Offenberger, that used to work the Western Hockey League and the drug awareness programs and stuff that they would do back then. And everybody knows the story how Maxie helped out Derek. Then to finally meet the guy that the stories were told about were pretty amazing.
So before we get too far into the NHL career, any specific moments, like any hazing from junior hockey, any players that you really gelled with when you were in juniors going into, that you saw again in the NHL, like friends that you still have from junior?
Oh, still have like locally, Brent Hughes. Brent and I played junior hockey together. So still to this day, Brent's coaching here, junior hockey out here. So I still do a few things with him. But Todd Ewan was a guy, and obviously we know the story how Todd passed away. But Todd and I hung out together when we played junior out here. So those are two guys, and obviously, Pokey Rettich and I went round and round, where Pokey and I played together, and then he went to Winnipeg and then obviously came back with the 90 Cup as the other.
Get everything you need to bring home the holidays on Black Friday at Menards. Doors open 6 a.m. A Nerf Blaster Dog Toy Blast Tennis Ball 75 feet. Fun for you and your pup. Just $15.99. Delicious Dubai Chocolate is $12.99 a bag. Color-changing Squish Lamps and Performax Drill Bit Sets are only $4.99 each. Menards has great Black Friday gifts for everyone in your family. Doors open 6 a.m. on Black Friday. Good through November 30th. See Menards.com for details.
Goalie with me in 90, so Pokey's another guy.
Yeah, Pokey was great. I always thought that he was very underrated, like with the fans and the media. He had like a really good cult following. There's goalies that have like those cult followings, and you know, they never really get their due with the media, and it's like the fans know how good some of these guys are. It's just, I don't know what, you know, happens behind the scenes, but Pokey was one of them. I really liked him a lot as a kid.
Yeah, well, a good story about Pokey was Winnipeg came into the old Boston Garden, and I just happened to be in the players' lounge, and the phone rang, and it was security. And obviously, there wasn't very many African-American players playing in the NHL at that time, and they weren't going to let him in because they thought he wasn't a hockey player. And I said, yeah, no, he's the goalie for the Winnipeg Jets, and they let him through. But, you know, it's just times have changed. You know, there's lots of diversity in the league now. And, you know, Pokey was one of the trailblazers.
Yeah, absolutely. Him, Tony Maccagni, all those guys like that, they were all like standouts. And like I said, they were all like, if you were a hardcore hockey fan, that Red Hockey Digest, like I did, you were all over that stuff back in the day. You had your cult followings and your hockey card favorites, and it was just a different time than it is now.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely.
So that first time in Boston, I don't want to talk about the trade yet, but standout players that you played with during those few years.
Well, obviously, Cam Neely, Ray Bourque, you know, they're two guys. Nifty Middleton, you know, Rick Middleton was just an awesome, awesome guy. And you know, nothing flashy about him, but what he could do with the stick and the puck for that era, he, you know, that's why he got the nickname Nifty. He was awesome. And, Reed Larson, really. Reed Larson was one of the guys, you know, my first full year in the season kind of took me on under his wing. Obviously, Dougie Keens was a big part of learning for me. Awesome partner. I mean, there's not a lot of bad guys in hockey. That's what's so cool about our league, where there's a lot of good people. And,
So go – tell us about how the trade happened, that first time going from Boston to Edmonton.
Yeah, I was, you know, I was just kind of cutting my teeth. I'm not going to lie. You know, I tell everybody that, you know, as disappointed as I was of going from the start of the year before to, you know, the Reggie Lemelin trade, and then not even getting a chance in training camp and going right down to the minors. And that was the first year that Boston had their own minor league team. So it was all Bruins signees. And playing in Portland, Maine was probably the best thing that happened to me because I could just go down and play. There's a lot about my first year in the league that I don't even remember. You know, it was just playing on adrenaline every night and not really learning how to play the game properly. And I think that almost full year with Maine was huge for me just to go down there and learn to play the game properly. As far as the trade itself, we were on the road. We were in Ontario. I think it was Aurora or somewhere like that. We were playing the on a long road trip and in Canada playing against Toronto's minor league team. And we had a day off and guys were all out just hanging out and, you know, trying to stay out of trouble. And we had a team meeting called, a little bit of a surprise team meeting. And that's when the announcement was made that I'd been traded. And I was a little bit in the dark. I guess a lot of my teammates knew that maybe something was a brewing because between their agents or friends, they'd heard that that Edmonton was kind of asking questions about me, but I was naive to the whole process. There wasn't a lot of social media back then. You know, cell phones didn't really exist back then much. And so I was pretty naive to the whole process. So it was shocking, not going to lie. At the moment, we really had something good brewing with our main team. We were rolling, playing good hockey. And it stung a bit, but you know, your dream is to be back in the NHL. But I went from, you know, what I thought is the goalie of the future in Boston to heading to Edmonton and playing behind Grant Fuhr. And I just didn't know where my career would really go playing behind Grant Fuhr. So it was really a lot of mixed emotions at the time, but it ended up working out pretty well.
I think so. But we'll get there. I think so. Yeah, before I get too far ahead, I want to have Ed and Tom ask a couple questions, and we'll put a pin in the timeline where we are. Yep. Ed,
sure.
Question for Bill.
Sure, Bill. Who probably had the hardest shot as far as you know, forwards that you faced? And then a second question to that, how was it like to face Pavel Bure? Because he was one of my favorite players growing up.
Yeah, no, Pavel was a great player. I mean, he was the type of player that you had to be really aware of, for sure. You know, just his skill, his speed, being able to shoot the puck on the fly, and then just his pure skill of abilities one-on-one versus a goalie. So he was, fun to watch, not fun to play against. As far as hardest shot with a forward, That's a good one. I'm trying to think who really – it's more the defense that I always worried about. You know, Reed Larson, obviously playing with him. Ally Afraid, like two guys that I played with, Ally Afraid and Reed Larson. And then the one big guy, you know, Al McGinnis, when I got traded to Edmonton, when you're playing Calgary a lot, that Battle of Alberta, Al McGinnis could really boom it. Those were the guys that, you know, I think of off the top of my list. I don't really think of forwards as much because they don't usually get as much time to shoot the puck as much as the D do.
Thomas, question for Bill.
Sure. Your rookie year in the league, did you have a welcome to the NHL moment that you can remember?
Oh, man. I think my welcome to the league was, you know, staying at the Royal Sonesta, you know, winning my first game. I showed up at the rink you know, I'd gone into Harry Sinden's office the day before, and he just kind of walked me through that, you know, didn't know if I was going to get a chance to play. You know, team wasn't in the playoffs yet. Just, you know, keep working hard. And I left his office and he phoned my parents to let me know that I'm playing the next afternoon. So I didn't even know about it. So I walked into the dressing room just all casual and the number 30 jersey was hanging up in the stall with my name bar on the back of it. So that was kind of the moment, the wow moment. And then, you know, trying to think, we were playing Buffalo and the first two shots, one was, I think Ricky Vive came down, blasted one off the post. And I forget who the second guy was. He came down, blasted off the post. And I'm like, okay, I'm 0-for-2, haven't even made a save. And the puck has been blown by me twice, but I think I end up losing the shutout late in the third period for my first NHL win. So that was pretty exciting. And then, you know, we went on to Buffalo, I think, two nights later, and I get third star in Buffalo, and I come back to the hotel, and, you know, back then there wasn't any answer machines or anything like that, and there is a pile of notes under my door at the Royal Sonesta with all asking for interviews and TV stuff, and so that's probably the first big moment of my NHL career.
So you get to Edmonton. And what's the first thing that hits you about getting to Edmonton from your experience coming from the Bruins? Was it night?
Get everything you need to bring home the holidays on Black Friday at Menards. Doors open 6 a.m. A Nerf Blaster dog toy blast tennis balls 75 feet. Fun for you and your pup. Just $15.99. Delicious Dubai chocolate is $12.99 a bag. Color-changing squish lamps and Performax drill bit sets are only $4.99 each. Menards has great Black Friday gifts for everyone in your family. Doors open 6 a.m. on Black Friday, good through November 30th. See Menards.com for details.
Day, was it pretty much the same, or did the guys treat you different?
The biggest thing when I stepped on the ice, like my mom and dad lived in Red Deer, Alberta, so it's right in the middle between Calgary and Edmonton, you know. So obviously, before I turned pro, the Oilers were the team that we saw on TV and a little bit of the Flames. So stepping onto the ice for the first time, just the speed was the biggest thing that noticed right off the bat, of the speed and skill of the team. Not that the Bruins team was chopped liver, but the speed of everything that they did was quite impressive.
So do you have a good Grant Fuhr or Wayne Gretzky story?
I've got stories. one of the great Gretzky stories is his good friend Eddie Mio lived in the Detroit area, and we were playing in Detroit, and we were all out late after the game in Detroit, and you know, we're coming out of the bar that we're at, and Gretz kind of sends me home. He says, you know, you're a young guy, and his line was, do as I say, not as I do. And he jumped into the back of, like, Eddie Mio had a limousine service in Detroit. He jumps back into the back of the limousine and goes on with Eddie, and he sends me home. So that was my big moment with Gretz. Fierzy and I just hung out we hung out a lot together, so there's not really one. You know, even though where you're quote unquote, you're kind of in a competition with your goalie partner, but we just I don't know, we got each other, we got along, and you know, spent a lot of time, especially on the road, spent a lot of time together. So yeah, he was just really good to me, and I think, you know, when what I learned in the 88 run helped me out in the 90 run, just of learning about the highs and lows of a playoff run. And, you know, I'll always appreciate that to this day.
So the great thing about Grant Fuhr is met him a couple times with my kids, and he's always been fantastic. Like, you know, just to deal with one-on-one, you wouldn't even know that, you know, no pretentiousness, like with the kids and things like that. It's great. The, you know, I got nothing but good memories of running into him a few times with the kids, and it, so I can, from afar, I can second that as a father of, you know, two young.
No, just a good person, and you know, one of the greatest goaltenders of all time. Can't take that away from him. You know, the 5 Stanley Cups. It's pretty impressive.
So let's talk the 90 Stanley Cup run. It must feel a little bittersweet that you come back and you kind of beat the team that trades you. That I know as a competitive person, it's got to feel good when stuff like that happens.
Well, you know, I think at that point I was kind of, with us beating Boston in 88, I kind of got past that. This was more about my journey in 90. And I didn't really think the irony behind the whole thing, by, you know, 2 years later, everybody, the talk was the trade was myself for Andy Moog, and that wasn't really the truth behind it. The trade was for Jeff Courtnell, and I was the throw-in. But 2 years later, you know, they tried to, that's how the media played it up, that it was myself versus Andy, and the true trade was for Jeff Courtnell at the time. So I try not to think too much about it, but you know, obviously when everything was said and done, you know, not only to beat your old teammate twice, but to do it in the Boston Garden in just such a great hockey town and great fans. And, you know, I saw a video, about a week ago, because the Oilers are doing a big documentary on from 79 to 90. And there was a clip of when I received the Conn Smythe in the Garden, and the ovation that I got from the hometown crowd there in Boston was pretty amazing. So, they're knowledgeable hockey fans, they're great hockey fans, and I was fortunate enough to play in that building as a Bruin and also get the opportunity to play in that building as on the other side.
So the first cup in '88, when you finally win it, what was the feeling like? I mean,
Well, that one was a little bit, that I'm not gonna lie, that was a little bit sweet because, I was disappointed. I really was. I thought I was gonna be Boston's goalie of the future, but it ended up being a great ended up being in the long run a great deal for both teams. Moger, Andy Moog played some great hockey, and the Bruins got into the final, 88 and 90, and so it worked out for both. But I'm not going to lie, obviously when everything's said and done and you get the opportunity to raise that cup over your head, especially being the first one in my career in 88, and it's against your old teammates, it's you're pretty excited about it, but you're sure you're disappointed for some of your buddies. But the bottom line is you just don't get the opportunity very often. Everybody talks about, I've get asked many a time, were you disappointed when you beat them the second time that Ray Bourque didn't get a chance to raise a cup? Absolutely not. You don't think that way as a player. You don't get the opportunity to very often. I am so fortunate to be able to have won the cup twice as a player and twice as a coach. You don't even think that way because look at the number of players that had long, great careers that their name isn't on that cup. You don't think about that even one bit, because it's so hard to win. It's the hardest trophy in professional sport to win because it's a 2.5 month grind to do it. And no, you're not thinking about the guy on the other side. You're thinking about, you know what? I may not get a chance to ever do this again. That's the way I approach it. So never once thought about that, about the guys on the other side.
The first time that you won the cup, you get the day with the cup. What did you do with it?
Didn't get the cup back then.
Oh, all right. Okay.
Yeah, I never had a day of the cup on either cup wins
Really?
as a
Oh.
player. So the first time I end up, I get asked that story all the time, and no, we didn't get the cup back then. So my first day was with the cup was I was involved with a BC junior hockey team here, the Coquitlam Express, and they were doing a big fundraiser and to try and convince the NHL to allow us to have the cup. Half the day was for Coquitlam, and then I got it for the other half of the day. So the Coquitlam Express had the cup for their fundraiser for the first half of the day, and then around 2 or 3 o'clock, I had it from 2 till the next morning. So that was my first time, and that was in like 2000 and I don't know, 2002, 2003, somewhere around there. That was my first day with the cup, and
Well, that
it was just a half a day. So
I'm so
my true blue first day with the cup was as a coach.
wow.
Yeah.
I as a lifetime fan, I never knew that
Yeah.
that
Yeah.
hadn't been.
No. That didn't the day with the cup. I'm trying to think. I knew the answer, but it didn't start till quite later on that you were able to have your day.
Well, you learn something new every day on
Yeah.
this podcast.
Yeah.
Thank you so much
Yeah.
for that information. But
Yeah.
let's talk about Conn Smythe run. I mean, 90, phenomenal in the playoffs. Not because you're on the show, but me
Yeah.
and my dad went to one of the games at the old Garden. I remember we got tickets. We had great seats, but we're in the last row, all the way in back of one of the nets. And you were on fire that
Yeah.
playoffs, Bill.
Well, it started slow. Didn't have a great early part of the playoff against Winnipeg, and then it just started to build and build. And the team confidence and the individual player confidence built. And I tell everybody the Conn Smythe, it's a great event, individual award, but you can't win it without your teammates. So it's an individual, but it's also a team award because without the guys around you, you don't have the opportunity to win it. But the thing about it is, I when I get the opportunity, for my, I don't even know if my kids have seen my name on it, but I know, the first chance I get to have my grandkids to see my name on it, that'll be an exciting time when they're a little bit older and make a trip into Toronto, or if it's on the road somewhere where we can go and see the Conn Smythe, it would be a real cool thing for my kids and grandkids to see it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So before we start talking 91 Canada Cup, Ed, question for Bill.
Bill, how do you mentally prepare for a playoff game? Like, where just is it? Do you treat it like every other game leading up to it, or is it kind of like you sit in your room and just kind of chill out and relax, or yeah, kind of take us through that?
I think that it's no different. It's you're more about routine, so that you don't get too caught up in the moment. But the biggest struggle I think that you run into is sleep. Try not to get in your head too much, and that's probably the biggest thing that I fought was trying not to just get too nervous before the game. So, we all have pregame naps, and that's usually where you catch up on your sleep. But playoff time, it's a little bit tougher because the nerves really sometimes get the best of you. But it's more about routine, just sticking to your routine to make sure that you're going into the game in the right frame of mind.
Tom, you're up. Question for Bill.
Sure. When you won the Conn Smythe, did that change your confidence level or your approach to the game at all?
I don't think so. I knew it was something that was special, but you don't really think about it till, later on in your career, when your career is over. You get that opportunity when Jonathan Quick won it in LA. That was the first time that I saw my name on it. And that kind of was, you start looking at all the other names on it, and that was kind of a real moment for me, where it's like, wow, the one thing I can always say, they can't take your name off it, and it's on there for life. And it was, I think that was a moment in my career. I mean, it wasn't even my playing career, it was in my coaching career where I finally saw my name on it, and then it was like, that's crazy.
So growing up, one of my favorite tournaments was always the Canada Cup tournament. I thought that that was like the best of the best for a hockey fan to watch. And that 91 Canada Cup, well, I think I recorded every game on a VHS tape and had them all for the longest time. Thoughts on that 91 team? I mean, it was they threw Lindros on the team and he wasn't even in the league yet.
Yeah, that was it was quite the process. The Mike Keenan brought in close to 60 guys for almost a month long training camp. So we had three teams running, and then they obviously narrowed it down to 20 some guys, whatever, 20, 23 or 25 guys, whatever we had when everything was said and done. So it was a long, long grind. And the guys that I was competing against down the stretch were, Sean Burke and obviously Ed Belfour, and Mike Keenan being the coach. Everybody thought that, Eddie Belfour was a shoo-in as the starter. And I was just kind of under the radar and just kept, I kind of continued on with my play and just kept getting better and better as the days went along. And I think I was the surprise starter, and I never let it go. I just once I played every single minute in that tournament, I believe. So, it was crazy. I didn't even think I was in the running, let alone making the team or being the starter.
Yeah, I think Sports Channel at the time covered like every single game, even like the odd games from teams that weren't even on the radar of being competitive. They just were all out with that tournament. And from a fan perspective, it was fantastic. So that always
Well,
sticks out.
yeah, I mean, you go back and look at the names on those rosters at that time. It's pretty impressive. High end group of players, you know. So I was very, very fortunate to be part of that.
So the move from Edmonton, how did that all come about?
The move from Edmonton
It's back to, didn't it went back to Boston, right?
back to
From
Boston. That was a strange one. Had cell phones back then. They had at that time, Cujo, they had traded for Cujo, and I think he was playing for the Canadian Olympic team at the time. Kind of complete irony because that's how the whole Andy Moog thing went down. Andy was playing for the Canadian Olympic team, and they tried to move Cujo and weren't able to do a deal, and so they threw my name on the wire, and you know, because we were assets, and you know, at that time, the Peter Pocklington was selling everybody off, and when they couldn't get a deal for Cujo, they tried my name, and that's it. It ended up happening, and I mean, if you would have asked me of any of the 20 teams at the time that I get traded to, I thought Boston would be the last on the list. And sure enough, the 617 area code pops up. I'm like, I cannot believe this is happening. And sure enough, it was Harry on the other line and let me know that the deal had just been done.
So you come back to Boston, and were you, from the fan perspective, were you welcomed with open arms, or were they resistant, or how was it the second time around?
No, I don't think they were resistant at all. I think the team was struggling a little bit, and there was that threat of not making the playoffs for the first time. You know, I think it was 20 some years, the longest professional run by a team, a professional team making the playoffs, and there was a threat that the team wasn't going to make the playoffs. And I think I ended up playing 44 out of the 45 games down the stretch. I missed one game with a thumb injury, played every single minute. The downfall to that was complete exhaustion when we got to the playoffs, and I was not very good in the playoffs at all. You know, but the fact that we got in, I think on the last or second last game of the season, we got in the playoffs. But I mean, our team had been playing playoff hockey for the last month, and we got into that series with Florida, and they were just running on all cylinders, and we were running on fumes, and I did not play well at all, and that didn't help things out either.
Before we get too far into the Boston second time around, Ed, question for Bill.
Sure, Bill. I'd have to say, like, what was your training regimen as you kind of went through your career, from, when you first broke into the league, and as you got older, it was what did you follow more of a nutritional program? We mixed in with weights, and we talked with Steve Passmore, and we talked to Chris Dingman, and they were really, they really started talking about VO2 max and that type of thing as their careers kind of went longer.
Yeah, I mean, we were just.
Get everything you need to bring home the holidays on Black Friday at Menards. Doors open 6 a.m. A Nerf Blaster Dog Toy Blast Tennis Balls 75 feet. Fun for you and your pup. Just $15.99. Delicious Dubai chocolate is $12.99 a bag. Color-changing squish lamps and Performax drill bit sets are only $4.99 each. Menards has great Black Friday gifts for everyone in your family. Doors open 6 a.m. on Black Friday. Good through November 30th. See Menards.com for details.
Just starting to get into nutrition and stuff in the latter part of my career. So, I mean, I always ate fairly healthy. I was always very fit, but when I look back on, I was probably maybe too lean. You know, there wasn't a lot to me. But I played a lot of hockey over my 15 years. So, yeah, I mean, the way the players train today and the nutrition is just another level. And, you know, there's lots of things I would have wished for. I wish for that in my era of to understanding the nutrition and the fitness part of the things. We trained differently back then. And I think, you know, having a goalie coach at different points in my career would have been nice too, just for somebody to talk to you. Just you relied on your partner. My first goalie coach was until I think year 13 with 12 or 13 with when I got traded from Boston to Washington. It was the first and only goalie coach I had was in Wash. So it's a lot of long sleepless nights throughout my career that if you would have had somebody to talk to, would have gone a long way.
Tom, question for Bill.
Yeah, what made you so successful in high pressure games? Was it preparation, mental toughness, or something else?
I think the, I don't know if it was mental, but just how competitive I am. I just, I tell the story. It's just was plain and simple. I had to be better than the guy at the other end. And I took it personally. And that's really how I approached it. I played in a, I was fortunate enough to play in a lot of big game scenarios, and I had a fairly good amount of success with it. And yeah, that was just my approach. I had to be better than the guy to, in the other end. And that, and still to this day, my, I'm going to be 59 in December. And I, when I'm playing against my kids, my girls' husbands are playing against my girls in sports and stuff. I'm still as competitive. If I'm anything I do, it hasn't changed still to this day. It's like whatever it takes to win.
Second, I can second that. Bill, second time in Boston. What did you notice any difference between the Bruins the from the first time to the second time? Even yeah, I know the player roster was different, but was there any difference, or were they still the same Bruins synergy, or?
I think the biggest struggle I had going back the second time was just the group was the city was different because it was I mean it was always a tough city to get around, but the players were really spread out, whereas my first time around guys were in tighter pockets, and so there just wasn't going from an Edmonton team, a little small city where it was commonplace for 10, 15 guys with their wives and girlfriends to go out after a game. And in Boston, that just didn't happen. We had, my time there at a small pocket of guy, like the Boston guys seemed to go together. The single guys went together. And then kind of the group of myself, Rick Tocchet, Craig Billington, John Roloff, and Dean Chenault, we kind of just click the girlfriends, wives, and we'd go out as a group afterwards. And I think that was probably my biggest disappointment my second time around, where we just didn't have that as tight a team synergy as in other cities. And as I moved on to other bigger cities, that was probably the biggest difference. And that when you didn't have guys living close together, you weren't as tight as a team.
Now, you mentioned Rick Tocchet. Do you have a good Rick Tocchet story?
The only good Rick Tocchet story I have was playing against him one night where I chased him down the rink. I don't know if he ran me over or whatever, and I went after. That's my one Rick Tocchet story. And we kind of laughed about it, when we started playing together. But what just a great hockey player, and now become a great coach. Just a good person to be around.
So the movement to Washington, that kind of came out of kind of nowhere for, being in the Bruins organization. They usually make trades like to with Washington, or they usually try to trade to the West Coast. How did that all come about?
Well, we were playing, I think we were playing Philadelphia, and I'm trying to think, it might have been Rick was hurt at the time or something. And he comes in, he goes, "I think we've been traded." I'm like, "What are you talking?" And it's between the second and third period. I'm going, "What are you talking about?" And he goes, "Yeah, I think we've been traded. They're going to announce it at the end of the game." And I'm like, "You're nuts." The game ended, and Steve Casper was the coach at the time. He calls me in and he says, "Hey, I think a deal's been done with Washington. Maybe just head home and stick by the phone." I'm like, "Absolutely not. If I'm being traded, I'm going out with my teammates." So went out with a bunch of the guys and stuff. And sure enough, a couple of hours later, I got the phone call that the trade went through. And because Washington was playing an afternoon game, I was Mr. Polin was sent his private jet to pick me up in Boston the following morning, 6 a.m. And Rick and Adam Oates were supposed to be on the plane. Neither guy showed up because they were trying to renegotiate their deals. And so I and obviously the trade was for Carey, that so I had to go there or they wouldn't have had a second goalie for the game that afternoon. So finally we're waiting and waiting. Then the pilot gets the phone call, says the other two aren't coming. So we take off and land in Washington. I go basically right into a Washington Capitals jersey that, after landing and sit on the bench to back up Ole Kolzig that first night or first afternoon.
So we're supposedly having Ole Kolzig on the show in a couple of weeks. So thoughts on Ole when you first get there?
The German temper for sure. But Ole and I got along great. I was fortunate. I had a lot of great partners. Like Craig Billington and I hung out together all the time, and then Ole and I became good friends. We'd go out. We lived in the same neighborhood, so we'd go out together in Washington a lot after the games. And yeah, no, Ole was just super, super competitive, a lot like me. But his temper would get the best of him at times. And once he got that kind of in check and realized that he had to keep it in check, he became a really good goalie in the league.
So we'll I'm going to have Ed and Tom ask some questions before we move on. Ed, question for Bill.
All right, Bill. I'm going to ask you a real softball question. What was your favorite restaurant in Boston to go out to at after the game?
I don't know if I really had a favorite restaurant, but we'd go. I'm trying to think what the. I know Newbury Street was one of them, and they were basically parallel to each other. I don't know if it was Boylston or whatever the other one was. That was the most amazing thing about playing in Boston. You could go to a different restaurant every single night, and that's what we did. That kind of the five guys, we just try and hit different spots all the time. We got treated very, very well in that city, and then if depending on what was happening the next day, we might hook up with there was a couple spots I can't I know I think was it was Daisy's and one other spot,
Buchanan, yeah.
Daisy Buchanan's, and I forget what was the other one just over there too that the guys would frequent. But if we were didn't have anything the next day, we might try and hook up with the young guys there later on. But it was amazing city to for restaurants. You couldn't go wrong hitting on those two streets.
If you're an Italian fan or a seafood fan, it's definitely a great spot to live.
Yeah, no, for sure. And I wasn't a seafood guy, but there was still enough steak and chicken to get me through in all the different places.
Tom, question for Bill.
Yeah, when we talked to Steve Passmore, he said he needed to see a lot of shots to stay sharp. And are you the t same type? Did you need to see a lot of shots, or were you fine with a limited amount of shots?
Well, I think probably when I went back to Boston, I think that was the big learning curve for me. And I think and then even in Washington, two very good defensive teams. So I kind of had to learn to play where you weren't facing a lot of shots, whereas Edmonton, we were kind of a run and gun, and you saw a lot of rubber. But every goalie's going to tell you the same thing. You always want to see shots early to get yourself into the game.
So we're back to Washington. We're talking about Ole Kolzig. How was it going to Washington? Not really known to be a big hockey market. How did the fans treat you? How obviously there was a good core of veterans there at the time, especially with Adam Oates coming in the trade.
Yeah, well, obviously, I think for me, one of the few fights I had in my career, I end up fighting Mark Fitzpatrick. I think my second, either my first or second start, and I kind of won the fans over with that one. And then it seemed to just kind of go from there. But I got treated very well. But like, it wasn't a big hockey market. We were playing at the old building at the time, middle of nowhere. Weren't getting a lot of fans. And then obviously, the following year, partway through the year, we moved into that beautiful, it was MCI Center at the time. And then that's when things started to kind of transition a little bit, where they started building back their fan base.
So a small hockey market in Washington at the time, not now, but at the time. You moved to another small hockey market at the time, Tampa Bay, and that was at the time when we talked to Chris Dingman, we talked to Darren Pooper, and it was really not what it is now, going to Florida, where you hear these guys talk about how the tax break and that's why they get good players. Tell us about the transition from Washington to Tampa.
Yeah, I've kind of blocked it out. It wasn't my favorite year of hockey, not gonna lie. It just didn't. I got hurt early on. Yeah, it just wasn't my favorite time. One thing I can say about the Tampa Bay fans at that time, there was a small, very small pocket of season ticket holders that were absolutely amazing. We just didn't have very many, and that was, the downfall. It wasn't a great hockey town at that time. Obviously, that's changed. They got new owners, obviously better management in there, and have built a great organization there. But my time there wasn't a lot of fun. We were just a young group of, or not a young, but kind of a combination of young and old misfits and trying to figure things out. And it wasn't a lot of fun to play hockey there at the time. Living there for a family was amazing. We had young kids at the time, living in a gated community that I'd never ever heard of, that there was gated communities, but that's what all Tampa was in the suburbs. And, had some good, Sandy McCarthy, spent a lot of time with him. We just, it was just a different time, and wished it would have been better. But it wasn't a lot of fun to play hockey at that time.
So we had Chris Dingman on last night, and he was talking about how when he was in Tampa, that Hulk Hogan used to hang around the rink quite a bit before games. Was he around the rink at the time? Yeah, I know he just recently passed away, but was he hanging around
Yeah,
the Lightning at the time?
there was nobody hanging around the Lightning at that time. No, there was nobody around. I mean, it was tough. It was really tough. I mean, it was a great place to live, because of the weather and the housing and the cost of living, obviously. But the hockey wasn't that much fun.
So, your last stop, how did you get out of Tampa Bay for the friendly confines of Detroit?
Yeah, you know what? I'll tell you that's a story in itself. We played Detroit not long before the deadline, and just happened to was walking in, and Scotty Bowman was there, and he just started kind of grilling me with questions, what was going on with my career, where my contract was at. And I just thought it was really odd at the time. And then they the day of the deadline, they made a deal for another goalie from Detroit, and I went in to see Jacques Demers, and it wasn't a great meeting. And Jacques kind of said, kind of looked at his watch. He says, looks like there's, 2 hours left in the deadline. Looks like we're sending you the minors." I'm like, "Really? This is the way this is going to end? I'm 13 years into my career. I think I might have been owed a little bit better than that kind of a response." So I just walked out of his office, went to a phone and called my agent, and somehow he pulled off, the deal that, I end up going with Wendell Clark to Detroit. And just, we're talking night and day, going from a hockey town that was just trying to cut its teeth into hockey town in Detroit. And was just an amazing experience with that group of guys that were there.
Getting traded with Wendell Clark. Do you have a great Wendell Clark story? Because he seems like he was very competitive also.
Yeah, no, a great story is our first one of our first practices. Scotty Bowman didn't go on the ice very often. And I don't know if you ever seen pictures, but he wore like broom ball gloves. He didn't even wear hockey gloves when he went on. And most times he may not even step on the ice. He would just kind of stand between the benches. But we're doing I'm for some reason we had three goalies at the time, I think. So I'm behind the bench at the time. And Wendell's in front of me, and all of a sudden we hear this crazy, weird kind of whistle whining sound, and it's Scotty Bowman blowing on a kazoo. And that indicates for the players to regroup. And Wendell and I look at each other going, "What in the heck is that?" And whoever was beside Wendell said, that's Scotty's way of telling the guys to regroup. And I'd never seen that. And I can't even imagine anybody in their hockey lifetime would believe that a kazoo was used to let the guys know it was time to regroup. So that was my one great Wendell story.
Yeah,
We were just, we were both laughing our ass off.
Scotty Bowman, you can't knock it. One of the
Yeah. Right.
greatest of all time.
One of the greatest of all times. Absolutely.
Ed, question for Bill.
Well, I'm going to take it right from there, Bill. I mean, who is your favorite coach to play under?
Favorite coach? Oh, probably the greatest coach. One of the greatest coaches I had. I mean, obviously Scotty with everything about him, but the greatest coach I had for that I watched running a bench was Glenn Sather. He had just a knack for knowing which guys were going, that sort of thing. But my favorite coach, and maybe because he was a goalie, was Ronnie Lowe. We just he treated me very well, and yeah, I mean, I was lucky.
Get everything you need to bring home the holidays on Black Friday at Menards. Doors open 6 a.m. A Nerf Blaster Dog Toy Blast Tennis Balls 75 feet. Fun for you and your pup. Just $15.99. Delicious Dubai Chocolate is $12.99 a bag. Color-changing Squish Lamps and Performax Drill Bit Sets are only $4.99 each. Menards has great Black Friday gifts for everyone in your family. Doors open 6 a.m. on Black Friday. Good through November 30th. See Menards.com for details.
You know, you have to understand back in our era was coaches didn't really talk to you. Like, you know, now as a coach, if you're not, you know, kind of making contact with a player every 2 to 3 days, they're storming into the office and going, "Why aren't you talking to us?" You know, so it's completely changed. It was nothing to go 2, 3 months without a coach talking to you. It just that's the way it was. It was just a different time. So yeah, but a great Scotty Bowman story was it's not even really anything Scotty said, but I was wearing my you know, when the trade happened, I had my Tampa Bay colors for pads, and Paulie Boyer, who is Paul Boyer, is still the athletic or the equipment trainer for Detroit still to this day. He was young into his tenure at that time. And Vaughn had sent me out my new pads, but in that time I hated new pads, so it might take me 2, 3 months to break in a new set of pads. I just felt way more comfortable in the old pads. And Paul pulls me in, you know, I get my new pads and stuff, and Paul pulls me in. He says, "Hey, just want to give you the heads up. If you want to play, you have to get in your Red Wing colors." I'm like, "Well, it takes me usually 2 months." He goes, "Well, then you won't be playing." So I was like, "Wow." So I got in my Red Wing colors right away and just sucked it up. But Scotty was just, "Yeah, you're not wearing another team's color playing for the Detroit Red Wings. You're wearing the red and white, or you're not playing."
Tom, question for Bill.
Sure. Is there a particular save or a game that stands out as your personal favorite?
I think, oh, I think there was the in the Winnipeg series, I made a save late on kind of a breakaway, And now you're testing my brain because I can visualize it, but I don't know if it was Hawerchuk or Steen or somebody like that that came down. I made a skate save off a breakaway, and that was kind of a if they score, it might, I don't know if it was an overtime or not, but if they score, that might have been it for us. We wouldn't have got out of that round. So I think that's probably one of the moments that I look back on in that 90 run. Yeah, no, I don't think about the game that way about saves and stuff. I look at how fortunate I was to be able to play as long as I did.
We will take the answer beating up Mark Fitzpatrick, though. We will take that as
Yeah.
one of your
Yeah.
favorite moments.
No, one of well, as a Bruin was squaring off on a line brawl with Clint Malarchuk, and I knew Clint was good old Western cowboy, and I just tried to be as scary as I could. And he's like, "Settle down, kid, settle down." I was just like, "Oh, thank God," because I was 150 pounds at the time. He would have just mopped me up. But yeah, that was one early on in my career with I think it would have been my first full year pro with Boston, and line brawl, and he was not the guy you wanted to be squared off with.
What I will say from a fan perspective is the era that you played in those 15 years was probably, for me, one of the greatest hockey eras of all time. With the characters, and you still get the line brawls when you came into the league. You still had the enforcers. You still had the character players. You still had the coaches that were characters. Now it
Yeah.
seems like everything. I know you're still involved in the game, but the game has changed in a lot of good ways and a lot of negative ways from a fan
Well,
perspective.
I think from the thing that was neat about our era was we're no more known for the goalies were more known for the style that they played.
Yep.
And now the goalies are more known for the equipment and masks they wear. You know, so there's a big difference. Like there's not that all the goalies play the same, but there's a lot of similarities that they're all playing the butterfly style and that sort of thing, and doing a lot of the same things. Whereas, you know, you could recognize the way I play, you could recognize the way Brodeur played, you know, go down Cujo, Sean Burke, you just recognize by the way they played. Hasek, you know, with Mike Vernon, you go down the list of guys, Fierzy, the way that everybody had their own unique style, because there was no real goalie coaching going on to fine-tune your technique like what happens today.
Yeah, I think the era that you guys played in too had some really cool, iconic goalie masks. Sometimes now, yeah, it's a little bit overdone, but at the time that was a good clip there of buying
Yeah.
posters as a kid because a goalie's got a cool mask on and.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I lucked out. You know, it just started to, the full mask just started to come into play early on in my career, so I was pretty fortunate to be part of that era, you know, kind of learning that. And yeah, I was fortunate to be, you know, I've got all my masks hanging up in my little office here, so I'm fortunate.
So when it was all done, the transition from not being a player anymore to, we'll say, civilian life, did it come abruptly, or did you know it was all done?
My last year when I went back to Edmonton, I wanted to go back west. And agent got the phone call, you know, talking to Edmonton. They were interested. And probably about halfway through the year, I realized that I was not a very good backup. It wasn't in my DNA. And I came to realize that was it about halfway through the season. Talked it over with my wife, and our kids had moved around a lot, and we were at a time in our lives where it was just like, okay, enough is enough. Let's go on to the next chapter. And but I didn't want to make it about me, so I didn't announce it. I didn't announce it till the season was over, because our team, you know, Edmonton was in a battle for a playoff spot, and we end up getting in late in the season, and I just didn't want it to be about me. And so I actually announced it after the season was done. So yeah, some people were a little upset by that, but that, you know what, you just let that, that's just, I felt it was more important to do it that way. And had a good retirement party and stuff, and just go on to the next stage of my life.
So we'll talk about the next stage. We'll talk coaching the Kings, two more Stanley Cups. Let's talk about that. How did that start your journey into the coaching realm?
Well, my first year back in New Westminster, we were building a home. So we were building our dream home. So I was basically the contractor. I also got involved with the Coquitlam Express with Darcy Rota, Kirk McLean, and Dave Lowry. We were just a tiny, put a little bit of money in each just to try and help build the profile for the team. Darcy Rota, I think, was the president, so he was overseeing stuff. And then I think, you know, they just asked me to come out the odd time to work with the goalies. I kind of did that a little bit. And then Dean Chenault, teammate that hung out with, was coaching in Seattle, and he asked if I had had any interest in being a goalie coach there. And I was like, I never really thought about it too much. And so Dean was kind of under the Hockey Canada umbrella. That's how he worked his way up and stuff. So I learned a lot about being prepared and you know, kind of practice plans, all that sort of thing from Dean. So I was very appreciative. You know, and I'd go up there once a month and stay with Dean and Becky. And yeah, so it was a really good experience to learn from somebody that was, you know, had been doing it for a few years. And then year two, you know, the Vancouver Giants position came open, and I, you know, it was an opportunity to be obviously home and do the job and work with somebody that was very experienced in Don Hay. And I did that for a few years, and one afternoon I got a out of the blue, I got a phone call from Mark Crawford, and he had just gotten the head coaching job in Los Angeles, and he called me up and asked if I was interested in being the goalie coach there. And that's kind of how it all started from there. And I'm now going into year 20 with the Los Angeles Kings.
So working with John Quick during those Stanley Cup runs, do you have any memorable moments?
Yeah, I mean, you know, he was a special individual. Like, it was funny. He played the game a lot like I did, very, very athletic. And, you know, I can't believe I'm saying this, but the thing we talked about was, let's save that athleticism. And we worked on the technical side of his game of just kind of trying to simplify it for him. And then when we need that athletic save, then it's still in the toolbox. And so that was our journey, him and I. You know, had a great relationship. He was very trusting in anything that I put forward, you know, with him over the years. You know, sometimes there was discussion, but yeah, the journey was unbelievable. And to be able to sit back and watch him grow as a person, as a husband, and then as a parent was absolutely amazing. And just fortunate, very, very fortunate, to have somebody with that quality of person in my life for as long as I did.
So correct me if I'm wrong, I could be wrong, but there was another part of that staff, that King staff. There was another Conn Smythe Trophy winner on that staff. Was it Ron Hextall involved in that?
Yep, Ron Hextall was the assistant GM. Dean Lombardi was the GM, and Ron was the assistant GM. And one of the neatest pictures that I ever got was when Jonathan won the Conn Smythe. We did a picture on the ice with all three of us, three Conn Smythe Trophy winners.
I was actually working towards the John Quick Conn Smythe thing, so it's pretty. That's pretty rare, even for iconic Hall of Fame teams to have three guys all play the same position, all on the same organization at the same time, which is that's going to be special.
Well, I'll tell you a great story that not very many people know. Well, very few people know. When Jonathan was with Vegas and they won the cup, his young guy Carter is a goalie, and so he was in the dressing room after they won it, and the Conn Smythe was sitting on the table and he was just looking at it. And Jonathan, I think it was Jonathan, took the video of him looking at the Conn Smythe, and it just so happens that my name is just above Quickie's on the Conn Smythe. So in great hockey language, his son goes, use the swear word, but he basically said, frickin' A, Billy, and he was pointing at our two names on the Conn Smythe. So that was, and he was about, I don't know, 11 at the time. So that was pretty cool. A pretty cool moment for me, you know, that Quickie was thinking of me and sent me that video of him and his son looking at my name and his name on the Conn Smythe.
Unbelievable. That's a fantastic story for
Was
you.
awesome.
Oh yeah. Ed, we're gonna we almost hit the hour mark with Bill, so why don't we fire off some last questions?
Sure. As a coach now, what would you tell some younger parents about their kids' journey through hockey right now to where it is now, and just give them some pointers on what they could do to kind of help them move through the system?
Well, I think the biggest thing, and a lot of people don't like to hear it, but you know, so many of us found ways of making the NHL without playing 12 months out of the year. And I just find in the, I think it's in all positions, but I think in the goaltending position is play other sports in the summer. You know, whether it's baseball, you know, stuff that's hand-eye coordination stuff, soccer, badminton, you know, big sport now, pickleball, just something different with lateral movement, hand-eye coordination. I think these kids that, you know, they finish hockey, spring hockey, summer hockey, go right back into the winter hockey again. And I think you have to realize that if you're an athlete, you have, I think you have a better chance of doing special things. And I think too many of these kids just get so locked into all these specialized programs, and they don't get the opportunity to, you know, spread their wings and play other sports that may help them in the long run.
Tom, one more question for Bill.
Sure. As a coach, what qualities do you think are most important for goalies today that maybe weren't emphasized quite as much when you played?
Oh, I don't think it's changed. I don't think it's changed from like I think it's attention to detail, work ethic. If you don't have that, it doesn't matter how what special talents you have. You have to have the detail, you have to have the work ethic, or you may play a little bit, but you won't play a long time.
So every time we wrap up a show with a guest, I always ask the same question. And it, Bill, if you had to define your career in one word, what would it be?
The biggest thing for me about my career was respect. And hopefully I had the respect of my teammates and I had the respect of the players that I played against. That was a big thing for me.
Well, you definitely have our respect, I'll tell you that, because I'm so happy that you came on. Very, very glad you gave us an hour of your time to talk about your career with lifetime hockey fans. And like I said, after this, it's official. Friend of the show, Bill. Friend of the show.
Well, I really appreciate you reaching out. You know, it's fun to talk about the, as we call it, the good old days. You know, and you know, I was very fortunate, you know, with you guys being from the Boston area, I was very fortunate to play for a great organization. Wish it would have been longer, but it wasn't. But you know, especially having that opportunity to play in that old garden is something that I'll never forget.
I can't thank you enough, and I just want to say that we appreciate all the time that you gave us, and we'll hopefully see you down the road. I'll see you in a month or two. I will say that.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Look forward to it.
Thank you, Bill, so
Thank you,
much
Bill.
from
Thanks
the
for your time.
guys. Thank
Yeah,
you.
thanks, guys. Really appreciate it. It was amazing, amazing time. Great questions and lots of fun just to hash out the old stories.
Oh yeah, we're here all the time. Well,
All
anytime you want to come back, you can definitely come
right.
back.
Okay, you've got my number. You know how to get a hold of me.
Okay,
Thank you,
thank you,
Bill.
Bill. Thanks,
All
Bill.
right.
Appreciate
Hey,
it.
thanks,
Thank
Bill.
you so
Take care.
much.
Bye-bye.
Get everything you need to bring home the holidays on Black Friday at Menards. Doors open 6 a.m. A Nerf Blaster Dog Toy Blast Tennis Ball 75 feet. Fun for you and your pup. Just $15.99. Delicious Dubai Chocolate is $12.99 a bag. Color-changing Squish Lamps and Performax Drill Bit Sets are only $4.99 each. Menards has great Black Friday gifts for everyone in your family. Doors open 6 a.m. on Black Friday. Good through November 30th. See Menards.com for details.
Four seasons greetings to you all from